Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenig saltas.
Hello and welcome once again to another Trademark podcast, number, I think it's number 97, we're nearly at 100. A lot of good content, and that's some shy content too, no doubt, but a lot of good content worth listening to. I'm joined today by comrade Dr., the very Reverend Sean Byers. Afternoon, Sean.
All right, Stevie.
It's only me and Sean today, it's the old team. We would have normally traditionally been held this podcast with our mate Mel Corrie, who we're thinking about a lot this weekend because there's an event in a couple of weeks by his friend Danny Lurgan, his bluegrass mate. So there's a big event commemorating our mate Mel Corrie. His other passion apart from communism was bluegrass music. I know that's I know the contradictions there. Don't come at me with your talk about bluegrass and what it represents in America. But Mel loved bluegrass. So we're thinking about Mel today. But it's only me and Sean today. And what we're talking about today is the understanding the rise of the far right. We've done a couple of podcasts on this subject before. And we've had a really good podcast with a good comrade, Mark Malone, from Far Right Observatory, which is now called the Hope and Courage Collective. We've had another podcast with Jarrow Insights, looking at how fascism won the internet and the role of how fascism organizes so well online. If you go back and listen to those, I don't know what numbers they are, but you can search for it yourself. And today, me and Sean are going to bring in a discussion about our work on the rise of the far right. As you know, maybe you don't, we're the anti-sectarian unit of the Irish labor movement, so our history is in the kind of peace process and in workplace intervention in the context of serious sectarian disputes. But over the years, we've also done a lot of work with ex-prisoner groups and with paramilitary organisations. And part of that work, a very small part of that work traditionally, was kind of keeping an eye on links between particularly loyalist paramilitaries and the far right in Britain, like so Combat 18, EDL, SDL, you know, Britain First, BNP, all that shit. And we've done a little bit, but it wasn't a mainstream part of our work. However, of course, as you'll know, all of that has changed, and it's changed utterly in the last few years. And now we find ourselves in Trademark, spend a lot of our time talking and also working in terms of organizing, but mainly educating. We're an educational organization above all else, I think, about the far right. I'm currently Maeve McDade, who one of our punters, she's currently in Madrid delivering workshops on anti-far right stuff with European trade unions from the transport sector. Next week, she's in Brussels doing the same with trade unions. And so last week, me and Sean were down in Galway with the Galway United Against Racism and Discrimination Group, a local collective of NGOs who are doing their best to organise against the rise of the right. And of course, we're doing lots of work inside the trade union movement in Ireland, but also in Britain because of our unique position here in the north of Ireland and the fact that, you know, we're organised through the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. But of course, me and Sean are both members of the British Union Unite. So we have that usual east-west, north-south dynamic going on. But it has become a big part of our work. And so today we're going to begin to discuss not just our work, but our understanding of what it is we're at and our understanding of who the enemy is. And Sean, we kind of delivered a few sessions over the last few weeks trying to help trade union activists and punters as well and activists understand that the rise of the right, because the rise of the right obviously doesn't happen in a vacuum. There are reasons for it. But give me your general thoughts on the rise of the right. Sean wrote a report about 2 years ago now on the rise of the right globally, or the international rise of the right, and it was for the TUC in London. Mariella Cohen of TUC International asked us to write it, and it's a great report. But Sean, you outlined quite a lot in that report about what's happening, why now and why not 10 years ago. What are your general thoughts on that?
Yeah, okay. Well, I suppose over the last 100 years, we've seen a few different waves of right-wing radicalism. Each have their roots in periods of economic and political crisis. The one that would be most familiar to people is the rise of fascism in the 1930s, which emerged from the economic and political problems of the sort of interwar period. We're in the midst of another wave of far-right parties, movements, and narratives. And this wave can be sort of traced back to the 1980s, but it's really been given a shot in the arm by the trends and the crisis tendencies of the 21st century. So what we would emphasize as materialists is that capitalism, in the West at least, has been in one long crisis for the last couple of decades or more. It's a crisis that can't be fully overcome. So globalization, neoliberalism, and austerity have provided capital with a partial resolution to this crisis, but it's come at the cost of making life worse for increasing sections of the population, not just the working classes, but the lower middle classes and beyond. And naturally, these worsening material conditions have created anger and resentment and insecurity amongst those who've been most badly affected. They're looking for someone to blame. The far right has swept in and managed to successfully harness these grievances and capitalize on the general environment of instability, insecurity, and polarization that's been fueled by imperialism, war, climate breakdown, COVID, mass communication, and the list goes on. Of course, all these things are connected to capital's attempt to reboot itself and restore profitability. And so what we're seeing and what we have been seeing over the last two decades is a resurgence of far-right narratives and street movements, but also increasing numbers of far-right parties winning elections, entering coalition governments and taking power in a lot of countries.
We should say at this point that all of our analysis of the rise of the far-right can be distilled down to what a famous Russian once said, Sean, didn't he? Fascism as capitalism in decay. And I think over the last 20 years, neoliberalism is in decay. It seems to be what it's walking around zombie-like, but it's not quite dead yet. William Morris said, and I'll use that quote again, he said, capitalists would rather bring the whole world down on top of their head before they would give up their privileges. And we seem to be seeing that at the moment. Yeah, and one of the things you mentioned there that's really important to remember, of course, is the idea that when working people and organized working class turn around to look for answers, they're not seeing it, are they, from the traditional left, if you like, or the social democratic left. It seems to be the social democratic left. We've had this before, this discussion, but I'm going to mention it again, that they seem to have given up on the idea of socialism completely or of alternative visions. And now it's just a case of, well, we'll have neoliberalism, but we'll just have neoliberalism light. We'll just tinker around the edges of the system in the hope that maybe things might slowly get better or not as bad as quickly. And of course, when workers turn to look to the left, they don't see the alternative radical vision or they don't see the transformative vision of the future, do they?
Yeah, well, the reality is for 40 years, there's been a virtual consensus between the traditional parties of the centre-left and centre-right on how to organise the economy. The only differences between them are on questions of identity, culture, crime, and so on. That's where they fought their battles. And the problem for us, from our perspective, is established social democratic parties over those last 40 years have largely failed to provide an alternative to neoliberalism. And then when the financial crash of 2008 came, rather than resisting austerity, social democratic parties were among those who were the strongest proponents of austerity and leading the attacks on workers, public services, welfare, and so on. So it's no surprise that people feel that they've, particularly in working class communities, feel that they've been abandoned. They feel that they've lost control of their lives, that they have no say in the decisions affecting them. And as you say, when they look around for solutions, it's the far right that are presenting them.
Yeah, those solutions don't have to be realistic. They just have to be plausible initially. That's all they have to be. It doesn't take a lot to convince people that you have all the answers. And the far right, of course, are expert at doing that. They have a traditional. And of course, they don't have to give very complex answers. They give very simple answers. And the simple answer is, who do you hate? Welcome on board. And that's it. And they give you the targets to punch down on rather than what we do, which is try and get people to look up, because it's a system here that's at fault and it's a system that we need to understand. And that means understanding neoliberal forms of capitalism. Of course, you mentioned there about people not believing in politics anymore, not believing in democracy, because it's a bit Tweedledum and Tweedledee, particularly in Europe. Now, I'm focusing now on Europe and Britain and Ireland in particular. We can talk about Latin America maybe on the next podcast we do on this stuff. But they get the two cheeks of the same arse scenario, that there's not really much point. There's no choice. And people kind of get there's no choice between these two parties. There's austerity or austerity light. And people are always banging on about a kind of a decline, aren't they, in public confidence in government and public confidence in political institutions. We see it in Britain, particularly at the moment, particularly after COVID, with the mass corruption that took place and the handing out of billions of contracts with PPE to literally friends and family. And I mean literally friends, a family of Tory ministers became overnight millionaires through huge corruption. But wasn't it always that way? Have we ever trusted in the West and in capitalist, liberal, so-called liberal capitalist democracy, have we ever trusted and political institutions. Why is this new?
Well, people have always had a healthy mistrust of representative democracy and extra parliamentary struggle. Going back to the earliest days of universal suffrage, extra parliamentary struggle has always been necessary to effect change. What's been different of what's happened over the last few decades is that neoliberalism has been characterized by an ever increasing concentration of economic political power, both within the nation state and at an international level. So there's a fellow called Peter Mayer who published a book called Ruling the Void, and he talks about the hollowing out of democracy at these two levels. So firstly, within the nation state, key decisions are taken at a distance from the workers and communities that stand to be affected. And these decisions are taken by a class of politicians and technocrats that are drawn heavily from privileged backgrounds of professional occupations. So you just look at the Westminster bubble, and that perfectly encapsulates that situation. And secondly, at the other level,
there aren't too many ex-miners in the Labour Party, and if there are ex-miners in Parliament, they tend to be in the Conservative Party.
Yeah, that's right. And at the second level, economic and political power has shifted from national corporate classes and national institutions to global and supranational ones. And that has insulated the market, insulated capital from democratic pressures at a national level. So if you look at the situation in Greece, when people voted to reject the enforced austerity program, and yet that's what they got, because they were told there is no democratic opposition to the treaties.
There was no democratic choice against the treaties, was the quote, I think. Yeah, you're right. And it's important, of course, to remember that, isn't it? And this is a thing we're going to have to address, if not today, definitely the next one, is this, because one of the narratives of the far right, of course, is the critique of some of those supranational bodies, particularly EU scepticism, as it's thrown out. It's always thrown out as EU scepticism. This is a really bad thing, that there should be no scepticism or critical analysis of the European Union or of any other international kind of treaties that, as you said, removes democratic choice from nation states and puts them into the hands of either unelected officials or indeed of corporations. So things like CETA and TPP and TTIP that was on the cards and who knows, might be back one day. And that remove of democracy, it's ignored by the left so much, and it fucking frustrates me. And I don't understand how we've let this happen to ourselves. If you're a socialist, surely above all, you're supposed to be a fucking Democrat. It's just, we want to extend democracy outside of parliament and voting towards the economy, that we want to see a more democratic worker-owned, worker-run economy. And yet we seem to have lost that vision completely.
Yeah, certainly. And even if you go beyond the confines of the European Union, as you say, this is happening at an international level. If you look at any one of the heavily indebted countries of the Global South who are in debt servitude to the IMF, the World Bank, and by extension, the dominant countries and corporations of the West.
Yeah, it's as if the concept of sovereignty, the concept of people having agency over their own lives through some sort of democratic process and democratic structures is naive, is old-fashioned somehow, and that really, it's only the right that now talks about sovereignty. It's only, now, I know they don't mean it, they don't give a shit. They talk about kind of weird national sovereignties that are quite racist and right-wing, we'll get to that. But the socialism is also about sovereignty in terms of sovereignty of the people and people's democratic choices meaning something. And the far right, of course, have capitalized on that. I mean, on that, as what you said, Mira's quote about the kind of the hollowing out of democracy and the idea that people can point to parts of our, you know, democratic structures which are deeply anti-democratic, and they've capitalized on that, haven't they? Right.
Yeah, and part of the reason why they've been so successful is that they've made a point, they've harnessed those grievances, they've harnessed those anti-political and anti-establishment sentiments, and they've made a point of saying that, look, we're not part of the political establishment. It's failed people. They've painted themselves as outsiders. They've attacked the elite parties and institutions that people see as responsible for their own daily struggles. They've acknowledged explicitly that something is wrong with how our society is organized. And they said that we will do things differently. And part of that is addressing the question of a sovereignty and restoring control, or economic and political control at a national level. And for those who have suffered the most under neoliberalism and austerity, for those who feel that they've been abandoned and lost control, this often sounds and looks like an anti-systemic critique.
Yeah. It sounds like a sort of set of quasi-left critique.
It does, and especially when the traditional parties are seen to be defending the status quo.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? Traditional left-wing parties and traditional social democrats are defending a status quo that is broken, that doesn't, you know, that's not working for people and not working for anybody, and yet they stand there defending it. And you can see that with the Starmerites and the British Labour Party quite clearly, that there's no critique of the status quo. And again, it's Tweedledum, Tweedledee, two cheeks of the same arse in terms of who you're going to vote for. And that long-term will not work. And this idea that somehow we're going to tackle the rise of the right in another 2 or 3 years, everything's going to be okay. I mean, honestly, I can only see it getting worse, because most of the parties that are winning elections in Europe are either centrist parties or they're far-right parties, or they're so-called social democratic parties that are really so far shifted to the right, it's hardly worth fucking talking about them. Sorry, you wanted to come in, Sean?
Yeah, I was just going to throw in there, like, in many ways, and we're not going to win many fans for saying this, but in many ways, the Lexiteers were...
We are the Millwall of the Irish Labour movement. No one likes us. We don't care. Carry on.
In many ways, the arguments for Lexit have been vindicated with the return to the nation state, with the return to sovereign control over the country's economic and political affairs. And there's a progressive route for that. There's progressive opportunities for that, but they haven't been harnessed. They haven't been seized upon by the left.
But it's not just that return to sovereignty and return to nation-state capitalism is happening everywhere. It's happening by stealth, though. I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act is part of that same process, isn't it? And yet you're seeing those tensions within Europe massively, with the Germans desperately hoping that people return to pre-COVID fiscal rules or ordo-liberal rules, debt-to-GDP ratios, which of course suits the German economy and the Deutschmark zone there, the Eurozone. But I mean, it's happening in lots of different places, isn't it? That kind of return to national sovereignty, the people pulling back the borders. Now, people are saying that's because of the rise of the right, the rise of nationalism and narrowness, and that's also true. But it's also as a response to the failures of neoliberal capitalism, which is a product of the treaties of the European Union, is it not? But I mean, what I mean is that neoliberalism is failing and it's collapsing around us, and yet the institutions that help promote it are still desperately hanging on to it, and there are tensions even within the European Union about that idea of, you know, can we return to national capitalisms and defending nation states versus a supranational body that doesn't need to know what the fuck it's doing. And then the Americans have pulled out of it, and the Americans are the first people really to pull away from globalization. They've said it. They said, we, because of supply chains, because of China, because of Russia, because of securing their own supply chains and making sure their economy isn't affected by this, they're going to start pulling away and becoming more self-sufficient in things like microchips and all the rest of it.
Yeah, and you're going to see many states pursuing this same path out of necessity.
That's the point. That's the point I was trying to make in a very long-winded way.
Out of necessity, you know, due to supply chain shocks, due to the impact of climate change, due to resource competition, due to the demands of their own populations, there's a recognition of the need for greater state intervention at a national level. And some of this stuff in terms of the type of investment and the type of intervention that we might see from the likes of Germany and other core EU states could end up unraveling the very foundations of the European Union.
I mean, honestly, that's no bad thing. But I mean, breaking some of the rules and some of the treaties is no bad thing. I mean, France and Germany, of course, we made this point before, have been doing it for years. Michel Barnier was asked, how can France, I think France by that stage, when he was asked a few years ago, pre-COVID, he was asked, you've broken the rules of the fiscal rules 12 different occasions. How is it you can break the rules and no one else can? And he just said, we are France. And that was it. That's all he had to say, that they can break the rules. But if Ireland or Greece or Spain or Portugal dared break, now they'd be fucking pummeled for it. But those rules, as you said, are going to be broken out of necessity, as they were during COVID, out of necessity. They didn't work for the economy that emerged during COVID. The economy had to radically shift its direction. And if we're serious about understanding the impact and the mitigations we need to adopt for climate breakdown, those rules simply won't work, and they will disappear out of necessity over time. That's really the next 5 or 10 years we're looking at. So having an EU critical position and providing a proper analysis of the critique of globalization and those international treaties, not just CETA as well as everything else and TPP, that has to be part of our discussion, doesn't it? It has to be part of how we look into the next 10 or 20 years of our lives and the lives of our kids.
It's absolutely necessary, like, because that's the way things are headed.
And until we do, of course, the right will continue to rise. That's my point, is that until we genuinely assess how we have to restructure the economy to mitigate against climate breakdown, the right will continue to capitalize on the less lack of analysis and less lack of presentation and alternative vision. But when we talk about the right, and I know we don't have, I think we should talk about it, because one of the things that we've been trying to do in our work when we provide educational courses and stuff and put on political schools for people is try and get people to think about, when they say the far right, who are they talking to? Because on too many occasions, and we know this from experience, people immediately think of skinhead groups or skinhead subcultures, or, you know, Patrick Alternatives or whatever, the English Defence League. They always think of skinhead groups. It's right to think of those, because those groups are a threat, because that's where working class people are often recruited into those groups. And they become the kind of street movements that you refer to, like Pegida in Germany, of course, that provide the front line for the far right. But when we talk about the far right, who are we talking about really? And how can we identify the individuals, the organizations, the political parties, the movements, and the governments? Because above all else, surely the far right wants state power. Isn't that what this is really about? So when we say far right, who are we talking about, Sean? And is it useful to do that, to categorize it in some way?
Well, there's a big debate about this, but for me, the term far right is probably the least problematic way of identifying individuals, organizations, political parties, movements, and governments, as you say, that have broad similarities in terms of their ideological outlook and program. And if there's one thing that defines the far right, the contemporary far right, it's a shared emphasis on ethnic and cultural superiority and nostalgia for an imagined past, nostalgia for a past that never existed in the first place.
When you could leave your bike in the hedge at the bottom of the road and leave your door unlocked.
Yeah, all that stuff. Yeah, when the place was inhabited by purely indigenous people.
Whatever, yeah, white people.
And what they argue for, or what they argue is that so-called non-native or alien forces, and that's people, institutions, or ideas, pose a threat to the native population, native culture, and to the harmony of the inner workings of the nation state. And they have a broad range of socioeconomic issues, but they come together and promote narratives designed to make the nation state more ethnically and culturally homogenous. So that's whether that's through assimilation or exclusion of those who are deemed to be out groups. The contemporary landscape is fairly complex and messy, as you said, but it, broadly speaking, you could say it includes traditional conservative parties. They've lurched to the right.
Well, you see that very clearly in Britain, because the British Tory Party now is one of the leading, you could argue, one of the leading far-right parties in Europe in terms of what it says, its rhetoric, but also the legislation and the policies they're enacting.
Yeah, absolutely. The Tory perfectly fits that category. The second category, I suppose, is parties that appear to have moved away from their fascist origins, mainly for electoral purposes. So you see that with the French National Front under Marine Le Pen, who's tried to detoxify her party.
Rassemblement National.
Yeah. The Brothers of Italy, they've taken power in Italy. They have their origins in a neo-fascist party of the 1950s, but they've rebranded and recast themselves as a normal sort of democratic party.
And although they were deeply EU critical before they got into power, what's their position been since they've won power in Italy?
Oh, the V's off.
Surprisingly. But that's a really important point. There's a far-right party with fascist roots governing one of the largest economies in Europe. Hardly a fucking word's been said about it. And as long as they toe the line on the fiscal rules, as long as they toe the line in the EU, nothing will be said about it. And they're perfectly welcome. And she's welcomed and feted everywhere across Europe. No one's not meeting her because she's the far-right.
So every day we're treated to pictures of EU bureaucrats and political leaders shaking hands with her. And
this is the hypocrisy of the European Union, I suppose, and the programs within it about, oh, you know, we're against racism, we're against the rise of the far right, you know, and the next photograph is them meeting a far right party. Yeah. So that cordon sanitaire that we always spoke about between far right fascist parties and so-called democratic parties is completely gone there in Europe, isn't it? And that's another sign that people should be worried about.
Yeah, absolutely. Like for a long time, that cordon sanitaire was in place in every single European country, where so-called centrist parties said that they wouldn't do any deals or contemplate any sort of collaboration or cooperation with parties of the far right. And increasingly over time, you've seen parties of the far right, first of all, entering into supplying confidence arrangements with centrist parties, then becoming coalition partners. And gradually, as they increase in their support, they become big enough to take power themselves. And, you know, the centrist parties and the political establishment have facilitated that in many ways.
Yeah, and the policies they're left up with once they get into power is the EU critical nature of the disappears, and they just become anti-immigrant, anti-refugee, anti-asylum seeker, anti-LGBT, misogynistic, homophobic. Those are those culture war issues, those targeting of minority groups and punching down are the only policies that they keep on board, if you like. And all the other sort of quasi-left critical economic policies disappear completely. Because why? Because they back the status quo. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're allowed in.
I suppose that comes on to the another sort of type of party that's emerged. There's newer far-right parties as well that are more firmly rooted in contemporary events and conditions. So that they're not tainted by association with Nazism, outright Nazism, or the memory of the Second World War. They've emerged in the 1980s, 1990s, into the 2000s. New kids on the block. They're addressing more contemporary issues, but they're still far right in their policies, their programs, their ideology. The likes of Alternative for Deutschland, AfD, the Vox Party in Spain, which is a really interesting party in terms that it's, I think you mentioned before that it's got a large sort of middle class support base.
Mm. And it's making inroads into working class communities as well. So it's providing that cross class unity, which is always dangerous when you see new right wing parties. They're not just rooted in one particular community, they're able to appeal to a broad church of people.
Yeah, and I suppose there's two stories coming out of the recent Spanish election. One is the return of the two traditional parties, the Popular Party and the Socialist Party, the return of the two-party system. But aside from that, Vox have made gains in almost every region in Spain, and they're now a viable coalition partner in many regions. On top of that, you have groups that are modelled on 1930s fascism. They're becoming much more rare because it's not politically expedient. Mm. It's quite toxic to be associated. There's still memories of the Second World War, of fascism, are still quite raw. So it's not politically expedient to adopt that sort of strategy, but they still exist.
Because we did see that right at the start, didn't we? About 10, 15 years ago, just after the global financial crash, particularly in Europe, you had the likes of the Golden Dawn in Greece with, you know, a double figure members in the Greek parliament. You had Jobbik in Hungary. Yeah. But as you said, they've kind of like osmosis, like been sucked in to other far-right parties, which have made themselves more amenable to elections. So you've got, you know, Viktor Orban and Fidesz in Hungary have taken in Jobbik. They don't need street movements when you've got government. And this is the point we all make all the time, don't we, in terms of mainstreaming and normalization. You don't need a fascist group marching around the streets when you're in government, because you've got a police force and an army. And that's when you know you're in trouble, because now they control the organs of the state.
All that's needed is for the government party to absorb the ideas of the far right.
We saw that with UKIP in Britain, didn't we? And that UKIP vote got sucked into the Tory party, and the Tory party didn't lurch to the right, moved to the right over the last 2 to 3 years as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Then you have sort of street movements that we've mentioned in the English Defence League, probably one of the most prominent examples, Pegida, which tried to organise in Ireland a few years ago, and they got the shit kicked out of them. And
huzzah.
They weren't seen again. And I suppose one of the newer phenomena is the largely US-funded think tanks and civil society organisations, as well as online forums and networks that have sprouted up due to the emergence of social media, that exist to promote right-wing actors and narratives, to suck people in, to recruit them, to transform them into, I think, they're soldiers of the far right.
Yeah, if people want to go back and listen, I just looked up the number there. Number 58 on the Trademark podcast is with a couple of comrades, and it's How Fascism Won the Internet. And it gets into that story in some depth with people who know what they're talking about. Because as a bit of a, well, I'm officially Gen X, I do have boomer characteristics. I find it all quite complex. Although I'm far better than you on this stuff, Sean, by the way, and you're a young man, you should be ashamed of yourself, really. But
I'm absolutely the worst person to talk to you about this. I shouldn't even have mentioned it.
But if you go back to number 58 on our podcast list, there's a really good, not because we are, because there's really good people on talking about how fascism organises online and why they're so good and so successful at it. So go listen to that. You'll find it quite interesting. Sorry, Sean, I interrupted you. Carry on.
No, I suppose just the point to make about this new phenomenon is that it's more opaque, it's more remote, it's more interconnected, and therefore it's much more difficult to tackle head on. But as you say, you listen back to that other episode of the podcast and the lads have some ideas on how to do that.
And there's also people we're working with, including Jarrett Insights in London there, but also the Creative Workers Cooperative, who's a really good graphic design and basically left-wing propaganda worker co-op in Belfast that we work with. They've got really good ideas on how we respond to online organising of the far right, and what the left more broadly and the socialist Republican left more specifically might do to get online and to combat, particularly in Ireland as well, because that's a concern of ours, of course, is the relatively sudden rise of far-right groups in Ireland. So we'll maybe get Clem and Jared and Alison on board to have a chat with us sometime about their new ideas for how to respond to the far-right online, because it's a really interesting area of their work that they're developing. Sean, we haven't got too much longer. For everyone listening, we're going to do another podcast on this subject, by the way. We're just starting this conversation. There's an awful lot to get through. There's a lot of interest and ideas. And if I only wouldn't keep sidetracking into giving you a boot, we'd probably get through it more quickly, but I can't help myself. It's just kind of I just can't help myself. But there's one other question I wanted to ask you, and in terms of categorizing the far right and understanding the far right at those different levels, as you said, from think tanks to street movements to governments and everything in between, is it useful to categorize the kinds of governments and kinds of groups we see? I know that in the report that you wrote for the TUC, you kind of differentiated between what we might understand as radical right and extreme right, and does that categorization help as a further way to analyze the rise of the right?
Yeah, that distinction is really, that was developed by a fellow called Cass Mudd, who's a political scientist. He's one of the experts on the far right. He's a bit of a liberal, but some of his work's quite good. And he basically says that the distinction between the radical right and the extreme right come down to their attitudes toward democracy. So whereas the extreme right is explicit about its rejection of democracy and even about its commitment to destroying the remnants of democracy, the radical right is prepared to operate through democratic institutions, whilst at the same time opposing aspects of the liberal democracy, like minority rights.
Trade union rights.
And trade union rights and so on.
Could you argue that the Conservative Party in Britain are moving into that sphere of becoming a radical right party, or certainly members of it?
Yeah, they're definitely headed that direction with the authoritarian turn, the clamp down on trade union rights, the right to protest, the increasingly anti-immigrant rhetoric that's development. So they're definitely headed in that direction.
This is a quick aside. It's really funny when you're on Twitter. I know Twitter's not the world, but when you're on Twitter and you see English liberals bemoaning the fact that, oh my God, what's happening to our democracy? What's happened to Britain? This is terrible. This is not our country. We're not like this. And the rest of the British Empire is looking in and going, excuse me, what the fuck? Someone said to me once that all this, that the authoritarian nature of the British state is just the chickens coming home to roost. You know, that as empire falls, as capitalism goes into serious decline and multiple crises, that authoritarianism that's being felt increasingly by minority groups in Britain, but also by just the country as a whole in Britain, is kind of the chickens coming home to roost. And the Britain's always been authoritarian. It's just never been that authoritarian at home. It's always been authoritarian in Ireland. It's always been authoritarian in the rest of its empire. But it shows you the perilous state of capitalism. That need to hold on to that system means that it'll become increasingly authoritarian at home and on the streets of London.
Yeah, that's it. They're important, the methods that they used in the colonies to shore up their legitimacy and to shore up the system at home. And I think it's only going to get worse in Britain. But in terms of the radical right, and their attitude towards democracy, I think you can see it, and we've talked about it a little bit, in the rapid growth of radical right-wing parties contesting to win elections, because it's effective. It's an effective tactic. You know, bashing people over the fucking head on the street isn't necessarily the most effective tactic anymore. So contesting elections, winning elections, entering government is the favorite strategy of the right today. The categories are useful in terms of being able to identify more reformist or revolutionary far-right strategy, which helps to inform our tactics for tackling them. You need to know whether you can tackle them through reformist policies and approaches, or whether it involves a sort of violent confrontation on the streets. But in a lot of other ways, the distinction isn't so clear. So there's a major overlap between radical and extreme right actors in terms of their membership, their networks. They've shared platforms and campaigns, and you could even argue that there's a useful division of labor between electoral politics and violent street movements. So
yeah, you're right. I don't think we have to be overly nerdy about making sure that what thing fits into what category, but it just allows us to frame our understanding of what's going on around us in a better way if we understand those kind of sometimes nuanced differences. As you said, the Venn diagram isn't a circle, but it's quite close together at times, and it shifts about a bit. So it's important to understand the difference between what we mean by radical right, extreme right. And of course, not everyone you dislike is a Nazi. To use one of our quotes from one of our workshops, we can't throw around the word fascism all the time, which is a specific ideology from a specific period of history, of course, which is deeply counter-revolutionary and is about, winning state power, but also, the idea of having a mass movement who wants to see a total reconstruction of the state. That's not to say that won't happen. It's not to say that's not in the thoughts of some of the radical and extreme right. Look, we've come to an end of that one, Sean. Unless you've got any final thoughts, I'm going to wrap us up here. I'm going to talk about next time when we meet in a couple of weeks' time to talk about this subject again. One thing you did refer to, we haven't addressed it, is this issue of populism. That word's been thrown around an awful lot over the last few years, particularly against the left and the right. So we'd like to sort of drill down into that to see what we understand about the concept of populism as an ideology or as a tactic or whatever it is. Also, I'm going to look at maybe some of the core narratives and beliefs of the far right and what is it they're expressing, and also that global nature of the far right. These narratives that we see popping up in Latin America, North America, and then suddenly in the west of Ireland, and then suddenly in London, using the same language, the same narratives, because that's also interesting as well, about which groups particularly they're targeting in order to build up a membership. And then maybe look a little bit about, we've addressed it already, but that kind of convergence of authoritarianism and neoliberalism and the concept of mainstreaming, this idea that these kind of extreme narratives that we heard of 15 years ago that we never thought we'd see being articulated in mainstream politics, in centrist politics, are now firmly rooted in centrist politics. And those are some of the things we'll look at next time. Are you happy enough with that?
Yeah, it'd be great to get into some of that stuff. There's lots of stuff to say about populism and misunderstandings around it and how it's used.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Irish Times love throwing it at the left. They love everything. Everything's populist. It was about breaking the status quo. But that's also part of the usefulness of that discussion, I think. What do we mean when we say populism, and particularly the populist far right? And then we can maybe, either on the next podcast or possibly a third one, we don't know, on the far right in Ireland. We might bring in a couple of people to talk about that, about how it's manifested itself here and also what we might do about it as well. All right. Well, thanks for that, Sean. I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed discussing those issues, and I hope the punters enjoyed it. For those who want to support more of these Trademark Belfast podcasts, they're a part of a platform of podcasts, a social media and political education project called Left Block, which you can look at on leftblock.ie. There's a couple of articles on there. There's other podcasts. There's The Week at Work. There's Northern Org, an Irish language podcast. There's all the ABCs of Green Politics. And there's also happening this year, Scoil Cosh Cli 2023, a political festival. Second one happening on the island of Inishere in the west of the country in September. If you're interested, tickets will go online in about a month. But if you're a Patreon, if you bung us a couple of quid every month, which pays for all this, you get first dibs on those tickets. So, I mean, don't be a mug. Sign up to the Patreon. All right, Sean. Goran Maragat. I guess San Foyle. I guess Tifmahu Revoad.
That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers and Slán go Fóill.